It's been a very fascinating day for me. The presentations that preceded us have really covered a fascinating landscape from blockchains to sidechains, bitcoins to cryptocurrencies. But now, thankfully, there is a subject I'm at least nominally qualified to speak to. At Copyright Clearance Center, creating a marketplace for the exchange of rights and licensing fees has led to the distribution of more than $1 billion in royalties over the last decade. The marketplace that we focus on, rights for the reuse of published texts, is a kind of fellow traveler for those operating in music, film and video, and even images and artworks. Though I'm sure many here are unfamiliar with Copyright Clearance Center, and if you are, direct you to our website at copyright.com. Now, we first helped to create a marketplace back in the days when the disruptive technology was the photocopier. And, of course, there were many who said then it can't be done. My panelists today are working hard to prove that it can be done, and certainly we are seeing that automated rights markets speed up the licensing process and reduce transaction costs. So our question is, where are these automated licensing systems finding the most transactions? So for the most traction, and also the most transactions. So for all of that, let's start with our panel. I'll move to introduce from my left, moving on out. First, Stephen White. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Stephen White is the CEO of Dubset Media, a company looking to revolutionize payments to rights holders from the streaming of DJ mix content with its proprietary technology platform, MixScan. From 2012 to 2014, Stephen served as chief executive and president at Gracenote, a leading global provider of music and video metadata and technologies. Stephen also held numerous other roles for Gracenote and played a critical role in growing the company from a small startup focusing on musical technologies and information into a digital entertainment leader. Then to Stephen's left is Danny Anders. Danny, welcome.
Thank you.
Danny Anders is CEO and founder of ClearTracks, a marketplace for managing and clearing music rights. Danny has worked with a number of leading media platforms, including The Platform, Kaltura, and Verizon Digital Media. His clients have included major content providers such as NBC, Comcast, Time Warner, Cox, and Verizon. In his spare time, he dabbles as an amateur DJ and house music producer. To Danny's left is Daryl Ballantyne. Daryl, welcome.
Thanks.
Daryl Ballantyne is CEO and founder of LyricFind, the largest legal licensed lyrics database in the world. Daryl Ballantyne originally conceived LyricFind in the year 2000 with Mohamed Moutadane and Chris Book at Ontario's University of Waterloo, and the company launched in 2004. In 2005, LyricFind successfully negotiated the first ever music lyrics licensing deal with EMI Music Publishing, and since then, LyricFind has established licensing and content relationships with over 4,000 music publishers, including Harry Fox Agency, and as well the Harry Fox Agency and Rovi. And then last but not least, on the far left from my viewpoint, is Steve Schlackman. Steve,
hello.
Welcome. Steve is Vice President of Product Innovation for Orange Genius, where he's responsible for the design and development of the company's online platform to help creators record and enumerate their work. Steve brings a unique perspective on rights technology to the company as a result of his experience as a partner in a boutique advertising agency, as a registered patent attorney, as well as a professional photographer with exhibitions in New York, Miami, and Istanbul. And Daryl Ballantyne, I promised I would start with you because LyricFind is the oldest of the startups here on the stage, more than 15 years old at this point. And you know, if we go back that far in internet time, we were all still getting AOL CD-ROMs in the mail. Yahoo was the internet giant, this was still in the heyday of the dot-com boom before the bubble burst. I wonder if you could tell us, you know, what was it that inspired you and I'm presuming maybe your college roommates to think up this idea? Was it because you wanted to do something on the web that you just couldn't do?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the first time I've ever been called the oldest, but...
I'm really enjoying that, by the way.
I'll run with it.
Believe me, by the way, it's no more fun after a while.
when we first started, we were actually trying to license as a consumer site in 2000, and And you are correct that it was all a bunch of us that were roommates in university. And my co-founder, Mo, was back there, and he lived across the hall from me in first year university, and Chris was next to him. And we tried to license lyrics for a consumer website and failed miserably. And we realized that it was essentially a gigantic clusterfuck. Shut it down and went and finished school and did all that, but then came back to it in 2004 as an aggregator, knowing that it was such a pain in the ass that none of the other sites that were out there would be able to do direct licensing, and even the larger services that we had spoken to that could potentially have the resources to do it didn't have the motivation to do it, that it was very much a nice to have feature at the time, that there wasn't an incentive for people to spend a ton of money building a system to track and report it, doing thousands and thousands of licensing deals to be able to offer this feature, which on an individual service level, especially at that point, was a smaller level of usage. And Stephen knows all about this too, because he was building the same thing at Gracenote at the time, that we both did all of the research and work to build out the system, knowing that it just made no sense for anybody to do it directly, that they needed an aggregator, that there needed to be some sort of central clearinghouse for this, to not just have the rights and the rights management, but also the lyric data itself that none of the publishers have or could provide. So that was our motivation to get into it, and we really didn't want to go and get regular jobs after university. And so far, that's worked out all right.
Right. Well, in fact, very well indeed. And so that first deal with EMI that happened in 2005, what was it like starting that conversation? Because I can imagine that it's a conversation that everybody on this stage has had to have when you approach someone who probably wonders, what the heck is in this for me? I mean, EMI must have said, really? Is there anything? Is there a there?
Yeah. So I spent a little bit of time working at EMI on the label side at the end of 2003, working for a guy named Ted Cohen, who many of you know, which was very educational. When we decided to restart LyricFind and come back to it as an aggregator, I was actually supposed to go back and work for Ted in L.A., I called him up and said, this is what I think we're going to do, and can you help? And he said, sure. And he set up a meeting for me with EMI Publishing. I spent about an hour and a half on the phone with them talking about our vision for the lyric business and how we could monetize it, and how we could there was a market there, and there was all this usage, and there was money to be had. As soon as they got off the phone with me, they called Ted and literally said, who the fuck is this guy? And can he do what he said he can do? Is there a market there? Should we license them? And thankfully, Ted said yes. So they did. And we got the deal done. And then one thing led to another. And we very slowly got the other ones done. But most of those conversations started off with a long period of them just trying to figure out whose job it was to license that. Was it the print rights person, the digital person? Was it the mechanical rights person? Like, was it somebody else completely? We had one of the major publishers that sent us a form and said, fill out this form and fax it to us with what you want to license. And it was a form for an individual song. And they had like a million songs in the catalog. And we don't even know what it was, know what they were. So there were all these roadblocks along the way of just the transition of the business to digital that, you know, we weren't the only ones experiencing. There was a lot of things that publishers were coming into then where people wanted to do catalog-wide licenses that weren't traditionally a catalog-wide license. So it was a very much an educational process. And then as we expanded internationally, we went through the same educational process with global publishers and others. But it was a slow, long build to get to a point where we had all the rights, we had the right systems in place, and could actually offer a viable service.
Right. Well, there's a lot there that we can unpack, and I want to hear what the other panelists have to say about those challenges, because we saw nodding heads. There's a lot that's familiar there. But let's fast forward to...
I'm bringing up really bad memories for Stephen right now.
Yes, he is.
Well, there's a cocktail hour later, so...
Yeah, thanks.
So
can we get an advance on those cocktails?
Talk to Ned. there's no table service here. You have to. So really though, let's fast forward to today, 2016, and so much has changed, right? And today it's a mobile world, and yet when I go to any of those lyric sites that are out there, so little seems to have changed. Talk about that particularly, and whether the perception from the publisher side of things has kept up with all the change.
Well, with those lyric sites, one thing to make clear is that all of those sites are now licensed. So despite the fact that they still look like they did in 1995, now they're actually paying royalties. The songwriters are getting paid. The publishers are getting paid. And they've generated a significant amount of revenue for the industry. There was a fear with those sites before that any change to the code and the look and the feel would impact their SEO, because all of those sites were built off of search engine optimization to get people who were searching on Google or other search engines to their site who were looking for lyrics, because it was traditionally always one of the most, if not the most, popular search terms. As everything has transitioned to mobile, there has been a decline in the traffic of those sites. Some of them have released mobile apps. Metro Lyrics and Song Meanings have done that. Some of them have merged into larger entities. CBS acquired Metro Lyrics, and it's very integrated with the rest of their properties now, and there's still a significant amount of traffic there. And others have dropped off a cliff. And last month, we announced our deal with Google that integrates lyrics directly into search results, which will likely cause them to drop off a cliff a little bit more. But a lot of it has been complacency, that they haven't updated, they haven't transitioned to the new world of mobile. Partly it is that as we've licensed more and more services, now you're getting lyrics in Shazam and SoundHound. You're getting them in Pandora. You're getting them in Amazon. You're getting them in Deezer and everywhere else at the point of music consumption. So there is less incentive for people to just go to a straight lyric sites. So it's a little bit of an adapt or die situation, but a number of them are still very much, much thriving. And have kept pace, and others haven't. But that's, I think, true in all facets of the business, not just those sites.
Right. Okay. So Danny Anders at Clear Tracks there, which is attempting to find a marketplace for particular types of derivative works. You face a challenge which may be familiar to the one that Daryl did, which is sort of getting the publishers, the rights holders, to understand there's potential here. They understand the value of sync rights. That's a bigger pot. But you're talking about a smaller pot. Why approach them in the first place if it is small? We have heard that sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Is it worth the squeeze in this case?
Yeah, I think so. Increasingly we've democratized the creation of content. And so, you know, when you look at everybody in the world being a potential creator now, but not really participating in licensing, because there is no easy way for them to do it, and because there is complexity, when you look at the amount of content that's being created and consumed, a large percentage of that is coming from user-generated content. But, you know, a lot of these users are creating stuff, posting it out there. It's being monetized by other people, but that money is not flowing back to the rights holders. So they're left with the choice of issuing a takedown or letting it go, or in some cases they can make a claim and try to recover some of the revenue that was generated by it. You know, what we're trying to do is let the rights owners get ahead of those uses and start to set their own rates and make it easier for people to clear both the publishing and the master rights, and, you know, use it in a lot more different ways. So if you look at the DJ culture, which Stephen will talk about, I'm sure, remix culture, all kinds of apps, people capturing content and creating content on their phone, apps, games, all these things that are being developed by regular people and not being really published in a formal setting the way you used to, there's opportunities to capture a lot of licensing revenue. So what we're really talking about is the long tail, right? Right now, licensing is really focused on the head, but the rest of the tail, which is a massive market, maybe not in terms of margin, but in terms of volume, it makes up for it.
Right, and the issue that we've heard about throughout the day is if you make it easy or make it easier than just the lengthy, convoluted legal process, if you do all of that, make it easier, then the alternative to piracy or illegal reuse is a viable one.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on some of the previous panels, listening to people talk about the resistance that a lot of publishers and labels put up when participating in these new forms of licensing and platforms. I've tried to create my platform in a way that, you know, removes all of the objections and all of the friction for a potential rights owner to put their stuff up and just generate incremental revenue that they weren't getting before. It cost them nothing to register. I provide 100% of the revenue from any monetization that happens. I pay in real time. Same day, I can pay out all of the rights holders same day. And that's still not enough. So you start to wonder, you know, what's it going to take for you guys to register something? And you know, I'm slowly starting to realize that the problems that exist right now and the complexity and the lack of data in a lot of places, somebody earlier mentioned, a lot of these guys don't even know what rights they have, so they can't grant them. All of those things present problems which, you know, increasingly I start worrying less about the past and focusing more on the future.
That's a great point. And you brought up about being able to pay the same day. We'll talk about how you can do that. That's a Bitcoin thing. But before we get there, I want to ask the question. We are at a Rights Tech Summit. How much of this is a technology challenge and how much of this is a legal challenge?
It's 100% a legal challenge. I won't say 100%, but it's not a technical problem. These things can be solved. It's definitely a legal problem because a lot of times we don't know what's in these contracts. Getting people to agree and move forward, especially when you're doing it through consensus, when there's multiple parties involved, is really time-consuming, which is the existing problem with licensing right now.
Right, and So when you're speaking about having a forward-looking view, one piece of advice I imagine then for rights holders of any kind, creators and publishers and the rest, would be to sort of think about the contract and rethink the contract.
Yeah, I mean, somebody in the previous panels mentioned, you know, at the point of creation is when you should start thinking about this and entering and keeping track of that information. So that you can move forward, because if you can track that from the very beginning, and you know, everybody's talking about how we use the blockchain to do that, but you know, there's a lot of different databases and ways to do that. But if you don't know what it is and you haven't been keeping track of it, and everybody's not in agreement, no technology is going to help you. So yeah. I think part of the idea is let's get this stuff squared away from the beginning. And at the end of the day, you know, whether you're the artist or just another rights holder, you are the one that's in control of your rights right now. You are the only one that has the power to go out and fix things and make a correction. So if you start doing it, somebody on the previous panel also mentioned, you know, yeah, there may be millions of tracks out there, but there's probably, you know, 500,000 tracks being created this month. you know, that's stuff that we could be working with right now and moving forward. So if we can start educating people, getting people to move forward and do things the right way now, we can create a much more efficient system for clearing the rights that allows everybody to you know, build off of everybody's work and still get compensated.
Right, and Stephen White with Dubset Media, it's the DJ mix market that you're focused on. But again, I saw a lot of vigorous head nodding from you when Danny mentioned control. How is that important in the particular case of the DJ mix?
Well, let me maybe take this all the way back to Daryl and Lyric Fine. I think what we're seeing in the derivative space and what we're doing is really about derivatives, very similar to Danny. We're focused on DJ mixes and remixes as a starting point because it's a high-demand content type, and our distribution partners want access to content created by the top DJs in the world. But the tech stack that we've had to build is about resolving rights for any derivative work, any mixed or remixed content. But back to Daryl, and the reason the lyrics piece is so analogous here is what we're really doing is trying to evolve certain rights types and in some cases create new expressions of certain right types that reflect the realities of distribution. And so in the lyrics example, there was an existing behavior that was already far underway of the distribution of lyrics through the internet. And for whatever reason, the publishing industry hadn't taken action against those folks that were distributing their work without compensation. And when we came, Daryl and I both, you know, us at Grace Note and at Lyric Fine, came to the table to say, we want to pay you for these rights. Everyone's like, great, you want to pay us. We don't know how to do that. We don't know if we have the rights to give you. We don't know. We don't have the lyrics. There's no way for us to fit. So there's a lot of education here. A lot of what we're doing here is educating folks about, A, what are the behaviors that are taking place that you may or may not know about? What is the revenue opportunity that you're missing out on, which is a hugely important piece? What's in it for the content community? And then what are we doing as technologists to apply technology as a solution? How are we making this easier for you to be able to monetize your content at scale?
Right, and there's a key point there, Stephen White, about the behavior of rights holders, I think, that seems to be an ongoing point of discussion here, which is a kind of a disbelief, a sort of a stiff arming that goes on. What does it take to...
Well, I mean, listen, rights holders have this endless stream of folks coming in trying to exploit their content, right? So it's not at all surprising to get the distrust when you walk through the door. It helps now to know all these folks and be able to come in and say, hey, you know who I am. I'm not here to screw you. But you still have to go through the process of explaining what you're trying to do with their rights.
And a lot of the time...
And the control piece is hugely important, as Danny said. We're not trying to take control from you. We're trying to create systems that allow you to control your assets for a new usage, again, in a scale.
Right, and you're doing something now that is the same as we were doing in the lyric space, where it's found money for them. And that's a big part of the selling process, where, like you were saying, this is happening now, regardless of whether you like it or not. And we can monetize it, whether it's lyrics or whether it's mixes, and get you paid for it. So it lowers the bar that you have to cross to get a deal done. If you're doing something that is going to cannibalize existing licensing, or is it going to interfere with a revenue stream that they have now, or that they think might, then it's a much bigger threshold that you have to clear, and that's when you're going to have demands for big advances or other things. But when you're going to them and saying, we're going to monetize all these mixes for you and actually get you paid off of this stuff that is not monetized at all, and there's no threat to anything else, they're much, much happier to do something like that.
So part of the reason I think the derivative space is a little bit more exciting from a revenue potential than the lyric space is because what we're doing is monetizing a behavior that multiplies a catalog exponentially. And just to throw out some numbers, you asked before about the market size. We do a lot of analysis of what this market looks like, and some old numbers, roughly 700 million people every week are consuming mixed and remixed content across the globe. Most of that behavior exists on unlicensed sites or on YouTube that's paying very low royalties. As we start to look at the transition of those behaviors into paid services, we're talking about $3 to $5 billion of potential revenue for the music industry. That's that's the equivalent of the decline that we've seen over the past 10 years in the industry. So it's not like this money has just gone poof. It's just shifted from the music industry to the distribution channels where it's being monetized,
right,
and the rights holders aren't being remunerated for it.
If I can say, that's a familiar story to one that we hear at Copyright Clearance Center. For many publishers, their biggest competitor is illegal reuse, piracy. Yes.
And the irony is, like, you have services like Spotify and YouTube and many others trying to find some magic algorithm to create playlists. Meanwhile, you have the greatest curators in the world with thousands of followers curating, yet they can't license it to those guys or monetize it.
Right. Well, you know, what I want to do, Stephen White, is to bring up something that anybody here can have a look at on the Dubset Media website, which is this monthly transparency report that you publish. And I would imagine that kind of data, if for those who aren't yet convinced, seeing it month in and month out must really build the case for you.
Yeah, it is a powerful tool. So we create what we call the Mixed Transparency Report. We do it every month. And what we're doing there is we're looking across 100 or so different sites at the top mixes that are being consumed. And then we're pulling apart those mixes to tell the industry what's inside of them. What songs are being used, what's being mixed, used in mixes the most, and what do those numbers look like in terms of potential lost revenue. And they're pretty staggering numbers. I mean, we're talking about billions of plays of individual songs, albeit they're inside of mixes. And so the industry has no way today outside of systems like ours to understand where that content's being used, how it's being monetized or not monetized, and what the potential lost opportunity is.
Right. And there's a hint there of a topic I want to turn to Steve Schlachman for more about, which is this notion of discovery. And Steve Schlachman, you're sort of the odd person out,
yep,
in this discussion, because
you're
not going to tell us...
fascinating. But
you're not going to tell us about music, but you're going to tell us...
It sounds fascinating from the outside.
Right. The most unhappy people.
Yeah, but so you're going to tell us about the challenges in the visual world, and that covers a multitude of sins. So you're a photographer, you know what that's like. And really, there, the challenges, I think, probably, well, they should feel sorry for you, right?
Yeah,
because it's worse.
There's a lot of different facets. I mean, there's, you know, millions of songs, there's billions and billions of images, right? And you have the stock people and Gettys who, you know, but a lot of people just want work, right? So it's not about licensing. It's about getting known and, you know, showing the work, not getting it stolen, right? It's a huge deal, right? Because it's easy to, you know, copy an image. And I would assume if you ask 90% of the people out there if they could just take an image off Google. You
know, I'm going to cover my eyes because
right,
I don't want to know the answer.
A lot of them will say, most of them will say, if I don't make money off it, it's okay, right? And so you have this challenge, right?
They call that fair use, but they don't know
what they're... Exactly, right. So, you know, so you try to... So the first thing to do is try to get everything cataloged, right? So so the people... Everything's so disparate. There's portfolio sites and, you know... And then, so at Getty, they do stock images. But most people are... You're a wedding photographer. You don't... You want people to get out there and see what you've done because you want to create new work, right? And so they're trying to licensing themselves, right? It's all about trying to get them work. And there's not a lot of that in the industry. You know, there's just so much is about getting my work stolen, but how do you find anybody? That's kind of the things we're trying to do. We're trying to help people grow their business, give them tools so that you know where they are, right? Rather than worrying about the work that they did in the past.
Right, and that's what I call discovery. You're trying to help people get discovered in a way, kind of an agent of a sort. Although I think you also conceive of Orange Genius as a counterpart for visual artists to, say, an IMDb.
Right, so that's the other thing. So music and film, there's the grip and there's the lighting guys on it. And everybody gets credit. They might, and some of them in music... you're the sax player studio, and you get paid, right?
In theory.
Digital arts. Yeah. Well, maybe you get paid, or you're supposed to, and or. So, but in visual arts, there's also a lot of people doing the same thing. If, remember, visual arts is everything from the icon to the ad at the advertising agency. And a lot of people work on things. There's studio shoots for magazines and fashion. And you have lighting and makeup, and you have your entertainment lawyers. And none of those people get credit. And none of those people get paid other than the payment they get when they first do the job. But they need that credit because that's how they get new work. And there just isn't much of that. They just, you know. And then there's the idea that if I put up, you know, if I worked on this shoot and I put this work up, they think that they're infringing, you know, that it's not their, they don't have the right to put that up. That's sort of debatable, you know. They worked on it. How are you supposed to show work that you did unless you can show it, right? So there's a certain fair use component. There's a lot of education that has to happen. So in our system, we're trying to allow the hairdressers and the makeup artists to be able to upload things and bring in the photographer and have everyone tag as collaborators, you know, so that we all know who worked on everything in the IMDb sort of way.
Right. So it's a business with a mission. You've got a mission to help educate creators and help advance their careers, but every business also has a bottom line. So how are you intending to turn this into a viable business model?
So it's going to be memberships. We're going to try to stay away from sort of the advertising scenario, because that's partially because everything in visual arts is about beauty, and so the system we're trying to build is going to look beautiful, and we don't want to sort of muck it up with advertising and whatnot. So that, because if you're going to show your work, you want to be proud of the work that you show. You don't. So if you look at IMDb, which is Amazon's property, which I think is really just designed to sell Amazon DVDs or downloads or whatever, it really looks like it did in 1995, right? You know, for visual arts, it can't work that way. So we want to build a beautiful system, you know, that enhances their business. They can be discovered. On the other side, we want to bring in businesses who are looking for talent, right? So that it isn't just I'm in the system, but it's now here are the people that are looking for people to hire and great search tools so you can find everybody. You know, I need a photographer, a wedding photographer that shoots black and white in Seattle or whatever, you know, so they can be discovered, right?
And the educational piece is something you've been practicing already. You've had a blog, kind of a newsletter, the Art Law Journal.
Art Law Journal.
And just because we've heard about all kinds of technology today, I want you to tell us in about 30 seconds about one that I don't think anyone's spoken about so far, synthetic DNA.
Yeah, somebody actually mentioned it earlier.
Did they? Oh, I missed it.
The synthetic DNA stuff is kind of interesting. It's just it's using a DNA that they embed in paintings and real stuff. It's not digital stuff, but that verifies who you are, right? And that's a big thing. We were talking earlier about forgeries, just how many forgeries are out there. And if you're a really good artist, then you go out and you get an old painting and you scrape off all. I talked to a bunch of people who did a bunch of articles about this, and they scrape off all the old paint and they use the material to make sure that it has all the same mineral content and everything.
So they're kind of creating a saliva sample,
right?
As it
so, that, yeah. So that when the Christie's looks at it, it looks like it's old. Yeah. And this kind of synthetic DNA stuff would help. So these are the kind of things that we want to build in, be able to offer as services.
Right. And Danny Anders, there is a technology we've heard a lot about today, which is Bitcoin. You alluded to your practice of ClearTrax to be able to pay people same day. How does Bitcoin let you do that? And the alternative would be, for example, what? It would take how long if you didn't use that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have the entire value chain under one system. So everything from the consumer facing transaction, because I have the relationship with the rights holder, I understand all of the splits for all of the rights. So as soon as the transaction comes in, I can take a look up all of the different rights holders involved, including all of the rights holders of any works that were used in that work, and calculate all the splits and pay it back out as soon as it comes in. So one of the things that Bitcoin has allowed me to do is reduce the transaction cost. I mean, it's really close to nothing right now because of the volume I currently have, it's literally nothing.
He's hoping to change that.
No. What I meant was because the transactions can be split up a lot of different ways, now we're getting into microtransactions. And people can set whatever price they want when they sell. It could be, you know, really small, which you couldn't do before because even using a regular credit card processor on the consumer side, you're looking at 30 cents plus 2.9%. If you're doing micropayments, you could get it down to 5 cents plus, you know, 5%. So at a minimum, a transaction purchase using PayPal would be at least 6 cents. So every time you made somebody made a transfer, that was coming out. Then to pay that back out, you had to also pay payout fees. Now with Bitcoin, somebody can pay me, and I can look up all of the take that transaction, calculate all of the splits, and deposit that into the rights holder's Bitcoin account in real time. And it costs me nothing to transfer it back out to them. So rather than the traditional model where the retailer pays the distributor and the distributor pays the label and the publisher and the PROs get involved, each time it's 30 days and 30 days and 30 days, and then everybody's taking another cut. We're basically just cutting out all of those middlemen and paying it in real time. So it really creates an efficiency, and when you have, you know, microtransactions and you have so many splits going in, every penny matters. So the more efficiency that we can create and the faster that we can process this, the more money goes back to the rights holders. So you may not be growing the pie, but you're growing the percentage of the pie that actually gets back to the artists.
Right. And Stephen, one of the ways that technology upends existing marketplaces is kind of inverting things and taking established players and putting them at the bottom, bringing up the indies and the new players to the top dog role. And if you look at the transparency report, just reading down the ranking here, you know, the recognizable names are there: Universal, Warner, Columbia, but then there's Mad Decent, there's Spinning Records, Monster Cat, so forth and so on. That makes a difference, doesn't it, in terms of how you approach the business?
Yeah, the mix and remix market, and I would say the dance music genre in particular, isn't as major label, major publisher heavy as other parts of the industry. In our mixes, we've got roughly 3.5 million mixes currently in our data set. They're made up of roughly 40% independent content. So it's a much higher percentage of independent content than you find in a standard catalog. And that's made life a lot easier for us from the perspective that licensing from independents tends to be easier. And so we've got today 38,000 labels on board, most of those being independent dance labels.
Daryl Ballantyne, what about that as far as the independents go? Because when you would have started Lyric Find 10, 15 years ago, I guess 10 years ago as a business, it would have still been a world dominated by the big labels, and today we are seeing the rise of the indies. Does that make any difference to you?
Well, I mean, we're dealing on the publishing side, so it generally tracks similarly to the regular market share of the publishers with some small variations, but we have, obviously, with over 4,000 publishers, 3,997 of them are indies, and then some. So there is a very significant portion of our market share that gets paid out to them, and we work with people like HFA and other societies like APRA, AMCOS, and others around the world to help pay those out. But we see, you know, a similar market share when we look at like the Billboard Publishers Quarterly that they put out with their estimates of market share on the top charts. That translates roughly into the proportion of our royalties that goes to them. But again, part of that as well is that when we're looking at adding content, our content team that is sitting with headphones on transcribing lyrics all day, they're doing that based on popularity. We don't get lyrics supplied by the publishers, or very rarely do we. So when we're going and prioritizing what to spend the time and money at, to add to our catalog, it's all based on popularity, which skews more towards the major publishers and that type of content. If we were magically able to have every lyric from all the indie publishers in our database from the beginning, I think we would see a fairly dramatic shift in the market share and how it gets distributed. But that's not a realistic thing for us unless the publishers actually take the action to provide us with the lyrics to put in.
Right, and again, a certain message to rights holders of all kinds to sort of get in the game or be left out.
Yeah, and it's certainly, you know, beyond just the lyric royalties, having them in there means that if somebody is searching for your song based on a line that they hear walking around town, and they remember a line and they search for that, if your lyrics are in our database, that's going to be identified, and then people can go from there to buy the song, stream the song, learn more about the artist, do whatever. There's all sorts of secondary income streams that can be established by it. But you know, to the flip side is that realistically, a lot of those long tail songs we're not paying a ton of royalties to, and it's understandable that publishers have priorities. They're not going to make a ton of money off of lyrics proportionally compared to other things. Like the market is quite large, but it's making sure your stuff is correct in your PRO or the streaming services is going to generate more revenue. So we understand that there's a prioritization, and there's you know, we're not up here on the hierarchy, we're not down here either, but there's a level that we fit in where you get to that point, you're like, okay, now it's important that we get it into Lyric Find and make sure it's discoverable.
Right, and I think one of the important lessons about marketplaces was something that was brought up at the keynote discussion with, I want to say Jim Dubois, but I may have the name wrong, but Tim, close enough. And I think it was John Peters.
Potter.
see what I mean about getting old, Daryl?
That's called the incorrect metadata right there.
Whoever said it, he said that the whole point about getting this licensing thing right and creating these marketplaces is that it's good for consumers and it's good for creators. And I see, again, some nodding of heads there. And maybe we'll go down the line, starting far out with Steve Schlachman there. I mean, that's the point with Orange Genius, right? Is it's good for consumers,
that's right,
and good for the creators.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know, anything that gets them out into the world where they can be found, they get work, and there's more of them out there for people to choose. So, of course, I'm sure there's groups that will get left behind in that scenario, right? The best rise to the top, but I think it's still overall good for the marketplace.
And Stephen White, that was your point to me, that what you're trying to do with Dubset is really about that. It's sort of
in a large part the dynamics. We haven't talked a lot about the marketplace piece, but what we're trying to do in terms of marketplaces is bring a broad set of rights into the platform and allow the rights holders to have full control over their catalog within the platform, but then reduce the friction of licensing. The licensing cycles in music are ridiculously long, partly because you've got a very large base of constituents. You've got thousands of rights holders that you have to obtain licenses from, but there's also this lengthy negotiation back and forth for each new right type. And for something like derivatives, you know, this has lived in the world of lawyers calling lawyers and 3 to 6 month negotiations around each use of a piece of content to create a derivative. That does not work in a world where you've got 50 million bedroom DJs creating 5 million hours of content every 2 weeks. It just doesn't scale. And so we've applied technology here to make it very simple for both sides of the equation, the distributors and the rights holders, to interact through a marketplace and to entertain offers on new use cases, new ways of monetizing content, and to allow that to happen in a very fluid nature within that marketplace. You can opt in or opt out. You don't have to participate. You can make counteroffers back to the rights holders. There's a very nice dynamic there, but it all works at scale. And it all works, you know, with blockchain underneath capturing each moment of what's happening here. So the bid ask is also a very important thing for us to capture, because you know the next time around not to go through the same bid ask process again. So there's some marketplace dynamics I think we're trying to change in terms of just bringing, applying technology to allow rapid monetization of content and allowing distribution at scale that hopefully will reduce a lot of this friction that now lives in the land of licensing.
Right. Danny Anders.
Yeah, I mean, to your question, you know, all these derivative uses actually create more exposure for the original. So getting a DJ that has a million plays, or getting somebody to remix your song, or getting it placed in, you know, some app that everybody's using, you know, creates a lot more energy and a lot more buzz around the song to begin with. So
Gangnam Style.
Yeah, even that. I mean, when there's an abundance of content and you're competing, you know, you're competing with somebody getting kicked in the nuts for with a million views, you know, every little bit helps. And if you can monetize that, it makes a big difference. It's just, there's just so much content, and we just got to speed up this whole process.
All right. So with that, I want to thank our panel. We have Stephen White, CEO of Dubset Media, Danny Anders, CEO and founder of ClearTrax, Daryl Ballantyne, CEO and founder of LyricFine, and Steve Schlackman, the VP Product Innovation for Orange Genius. My name is Chris Keneally. Thanks very much indeed for inviting us here.
Thank you.